Right, good morning everyone, and welcome to our fortnightly economic update. I'm Victoria Clark, and I'll be joined in a moment by my colleague John Wynne-Evans. He's Head of Investment Strategy, and in addition to our regular economic update, we'll hear some great insights, I'm sure, from John. He's got a wealth of experience across various periods of financial crises, not least the great financial crisis, and so he's extremely well placed to give us some insights and commentary today amidst the coronavirus disruption. But before we get going, just a few housekeeping points it would be great for everybody to be aware of. So firstly, you've all automatically been placed on mute. If you would like to, you can submit questions throughout today's session. There's a Q&A feature on the right-hand side of your panel. So do pop your questions in there and we'll do our best to answer those, as many as we can, towards the end of the session. You can just type it under Ask All Panelists and we can run through those. If you do have any technical issues, any audio issues at any point in the session, you can also pop those in there and our audio visual team will contact you and do their best to resolve them. Note we are recording the session today. A link will be emailed to you soon. And then just finally, there is going to be an option for feedback at the end of the session. It would be great if you can pop something in there before you log off at the end. So without further ado, I'll start with an update on the economic situation because we've had quite a lot of big developments in the last couple of weeks, particularly for those that joined our fortnightly mid-year update. Actually, it was the last one. There's been much that's happened since then. So, firstly, we've had further evidence that the UK economy did find its bottom in April. So we've been talking about this for quite a while, and we had confirmation in some GDP figures that we had out yesterday. So we had a rise in GDP in May of 1.8%, which typically is kind of pop the champagne corks type GDP numbers. But after the drops in GDP that we've had in March and April, which were down about 6.9% in March and a drop of more than 20% in April, it's it's a tepid recovery in the scheme of that. And what we saw really within those numbers was a pretty robust recovery coming through in production and in construction, which are the second and third largest sectors of the UK economy. And partly that reflected the more than 40% drop that we saw in construction output in April. So, you know, the ground for a recovery there was easier to come through. But also for services, the tepidness of the rise in GDP overall was not helped by the fact that services, which is the lion's share of the UK economy, expanded by just 0.9%. And I think what we're seeing there really is a reflection of the way that the economic restrictions have affected what economic activity is possible. And for those regular listeners, we've been talking for a while about the restrictions being the kind of critical driver of the activity. But obviously, as we've moved through those phases of the restrictions, we've moved from some easing in mid-May to non-essential shops in England being operational from mid-June, and then obviously to a much looser set of restrictions in England from the 4th of July. So, you know, if you look at these numbers at face value, you know, it's pretty difficult news to digest. But at the same time, you know, one would expect that for the services sector, which, as I say, is the lion's share of the economy, that recovery emerges more strongly in June and in the July figures. But as we stand at the moment, certainly they seem to suggest some downside to our current Q2 GDP forecast, which is for a 19.7% contraction. But the figures, I mean, it's just very they're big figures in all directions at the moment. The uncertainty is obviously enormous. And I think the Statistics Office, as much as the forecasters and anyone else working with economic numbers right now, has got their work cut out in putting these together. So, you know, there is downside to the numbers, but there is a lot of uncertainty. And as I say, we are hopeful still that we see more recovery coming through in June and July. Just sort of adding to the, the news yesterday, we also had from the Office for Budget Responsibility, which is the Independent Forecasting Office, an update from them on their latest GDP outlook scenarios. So they were talking about the economy seeing its biggest annual decline in 300 years. So obviously a pretty stark headline there. Numbers for their expected case scenarios for a 12.4% drop in GDP over the year. So again, you know, extremely severe. They hadn't built in the latest government support that's come through, but, you know, nevertheless, kind of adding to those headlines about how far the economy still has to recover. So it has found its bottom, but the recovery has got a hell of a long way to go after those two initial drops that we saw in March and April. Now, again, regular listeners will be used to me talking quite a bit about our sort of enthusiasm for the indirect metrics of economic activity, because we're really trying to grasp how much the economy is recovering through the phases of the easing of restrictions. And, you know, adding to that, I think we're seeing more signs that the recovery is continuing on transportation volumes, electricity consumption. You know, the footfall numbers that we've been looking at do suggest that activity is picking up. But again, it's a kind of gradual recovery, and still the economy is still very disrupted at low levels. So, you know, for now, we're maintaining our GDP forecasts, which are effectively for a lopsided V. So the economy has come down very sharply. We expect it to recover, but it's going to take quite some time for us to reach the top of the V, for the recovery to take us back to where we were pre-COVID. And we're still looking for around about an 8% fall in GDP in 2020 and a recovery of a little more than 6% next year. But as I say, there is huge uncertainty still, you know, not least over what other kind of key factors there are, such as development on the vaccine front. Now, another piece of critical information that has come through in the last fortnight is that we had the summer statement from the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Rishi Sunak, and he is very focused on the sort of second round implications of these economic numbers, particularly the jobs numbers. So, you know, we're getting many anecdotal reports in recent days and weeks of companies preparing to or announcing redundancies. So he is now, Chancellor is now doing what he can to try and stem the slide, the number of layoffs, but also make sure that the economy and businesses are in a good position to take up any labour slack that emerges. So there were three planks to his fiscal announcements last week. So it's supporting jobs with things like an incentive, a financial incentive for firms to keep workers on after the end of the furlough scheme at the end of October, a protecting jobs element where we saw, say, the VAT cut for the hospitality sector, and also creating jobs. And one thing that kind of comes under this umbrella is the stamp duty land tax change, where the threshold for zero charge is now up to 500,000 at least until the end of March next year. So it was actually a very jobs focused announcement, which seems to be the right thing, the right space to be, because we are looking very closely at the extent to which the economic downturn sort of turns into a second round phase as people get laid off, as the furlough scheme winds down, unemployment rises, and that potentially applies a new squeeze through next year. So you know, Mr. Sunak's basically tried to address that head on and with a pretty sizable package. The key question that follows, obviously, is how much of a dent will all of that make? For some firms, you know, clearly, you know, if they're looking at the odd month or two, it may well help. But our suspicion is that, you know, this isn't the answer to every, you know, every business's prayers. It, you know, it will help ease some of the pressures, but there are some significant pressures there, you know, still very evident. And whether, you know, £1,000 incentive to keep on a furloughed worker will help, you know, it may do at the margin, but, you know, we do expect to see unemployment rising markedly actually towards the end of this year. Another couple of final points before I hand across to John. Firstly, it's not the end of the fiscal announcements. We have an autumn budget. We also have a spending review due in the autumn, and the numbers that we got from the Office for Budget Responsibility yesterday show just how stark the, you know, the fiscal consequences, not just of the summer statement, but actually the full package broadly, and, you know, the tax losses that have come about with the crisis are, because the forecasting office are talking about the biggest unprecedented peacetime rise in borrowing. They're talking about £322 billion in 2021. So clearly there are some decisions to be made. And I think the autumn statement is going to be the time that we're going to start to hear some steers on what Mr. Sunak's plan, Mr. Johnson's plan as well, is going to be to put the public finances on a sustainable trajectory. And Mr. Johnson has said he doesn't want to return to austerity. So we clearly need to hear what the plan is going to be. Is it going to be a consolidation over a much longer horizon, for example? So in conclusion, the UK economy is confirmed as having found its low. The recovery has been recorded in May. It was a relatively tepid one, but we have optimism that we'll see more through June and July. And those indirect metrics of activity are certainly continuing to show that. So we still think a V-shaped recovery is likely, but it's a lopsided one. And, you know, there's an open question, really, which is how far up that sort of second side of the V do we come? But, you know, clearly further questions, which are still yet unanswered, relate to how quickly we might see a vaccine. You know, is there going to be an unmanageable second wave later this year? Our assumption is that we don't see one, at least one that overwhelms the NHS and therefore requires the government to move sort of full force into another set of lockdowns. But that would pose further downside risk to our forecast. And, you know, critically, we're still in the early days of seeing how the COVID case numbers respond to the more recent reopening, particularly in Scotland as of today. So it will be important to watch the numbers over the next few days. And you know, we hope that we don't see the rising case numbers, which have triggered a wave of reversals in the easing restrictions in many, say, US southern states. So I will leave it there. I'll pass across to John now, and I will see you again for some question and answers towards the end of the session.
Okay, thank you very much, Victoria, and good morning, everybody. And I thought to start off today, I'd talk a little bit, just make some observations about the first half of the year and how performance has been and how portfolios would have looked over that time. Because in many respects, I think people might be surprised what has happened over the first half of the year. It's been obviously a roller coaster ride, particularly for stock markets. And of course, when we hear the news reports coming through and read the front pages of the papers, it's always X billions or trillions of pounds being wiped off equities. But on the other hand, no one ever tells you about what's going on in the bond markets or in other areas of the markets. And of course, we here at Investec Wealth and Investment generally run what we would call balanced portfolios, which have all sorts of exposure to other things other than just shares in them as well. And interestingly, last week I was looking at the performance charts for the first half of the year, and just looking at an index from the FTSE balanced private clients indices, it showed that a sort of standard balanced portfolio was exactly 0% for the year to date at the end of last week. So all of that stress that we've been through in the first half of the year, you could say for nothing at the end of the day. Of course, not everything has been flat during that period. Definitely, there's been, as I say, the big roller coaster ride with equities. But overall, you know, if you look at global equity markets, they're about flat on the year currently. Obviously, the US market has been the sort of one of the standout performers, having dropped and then recovered about 40% from its lows. Unfortunately, the UK equity market has been one of the big laggards in all of this. It's currently still down around about 18% for the year to date. A lot of that is to do with the fact there's been some potential for big dividend cuts from UK companies, some of them by choice, some of them by sort of mandated by regulators. And that has definitely been a holding back factor for the UK. And also, we don't have that exposure to big technology companies as they have in the US. Only about 1% of the UK stock market is represented by what we would call technology, whereas in the US, it's about a quarter of the market, and possibly slightly more if you take in other sort of types of industries which have been positively affected by the COVID experience. Bonds have done very well, obviously, in the first half of the year. You're now looking at all-time low bond yields for gilts. And probably the best performing asset class so far this year actually has been gold, which tells its own interesting story about people wishing to take out insurance policies against possible worse scenarios in the future, possibly a worsening of the coronavirus situation. The possibility of inflation coming through in the future with all this liquidity that's being provided, for example. So there's lots of things pulling and pushing portfolios. But as I say, so far this year, we've created all this sort of volatility to get not very far in the end. And I think, you know, another question that people tend to ask me, and, you know, Victoria just referred to how bad some of the economic data has been. And it was released yesterday, we've had the backwards looking second quarter GDP figures for the UK. And yet, you know, financial markets have recovered very strongly. And it's often a question that people say, so why is there this dislocation? The US in America, they have a nice phrase for it, which is Wall Street versus Main Street. We don't have anything quite the same here in the UK. Maybe we call it the city versus the country, for example. And it's because financial markets are forward-looking. And as Victoria alluded to, it's fairly clear that we actually reached the trough of global economic activity several months ago, probably about 3 months ago now, in the second week of April. And so when you see this economic data coming through now, it's very much, you know, in the rearview mirror. And the stock market investors might very much be looking at events through the windscreen ahead of them rather than what's going on behind them. And certainly we do now have access to this sort of real-time almost and high-frequency data, which enables us to track much more closely what's going on in economies. Things like Google mobility data. So now we're tracking so many more things through our mobile phones, for example. So that's uploaded to Google and people can see just, you know, how people are moving around in various cities and countries around the world. Restaurant bookings, that's been quite an interesting one to watch as people are coming out of lockdown, for example. There was an extraordinary situation a few weeks ago when restaurant bookings in Germany seemed to be actually up year on year. But I do wonder whether or not that was just because people were actually using restaurant booking apps for the first time that they never had to use before, because now you have to make sure that you can get a seat in a restaurant rather than just wandering in. Given the reduced capacity there is for seating in the new socially distanced world, for example. But obviously there's a bit of a price to pay for seeing this data more in sort of real time. That means the market has to and can react to it more quickly. So, you know, every day when new bits of data come up, the market can chop around a little bit. But the underlying trend definitely has been better over the last 2 to 3 months as we've seen this improving. So now I think the key thing obviously is to look forward to the second half of the year and what we have ahead of us and what the shape of the recovery is going to be. And what I've been doing is to sort of break it down into four potential scenarios and then look to very subjectively, I must say, probability weight them as to how they might turn out. And they all equate to one of the letters of recovery that we've been talking about. So Victoria, they were talking about the sort of the V-shaped and the extended U, for example. We've seen all sorts of people trying to describe, we've had Nike swooshes and all sorts of things to describe the shape of the recovery and how it might look on a graph. So the first one and the most optimistic one for the V-shaped recovery, what I've called the silver bullet scenario, is the early development and distribution of a vaccine. Now, just last night, we had some news from the US from a company called Moderna, which has a very new technology, messenger RNA, which has never really been tried before to create a vaccine. And they said that there was some success with just 45 participants in first phase clinical trials who did create antibodies. So that was taken quite well by the market. And certainly, you know, as I say, if a vaccine were to appear soon, I think that would be taken as exceptionally good news. However, there are so many caveats around this, particularly about the safety of vaccines. We know there are all sorts of side effects that can happen with these things. Then there's the sort of, you know, potential for distributing a vaccine. You'd have to maybe get 4 or 5 billion people around the planet to accept taking one and to get it out to them in a reasonably easy and early scope of time. And that itself is a huge logistical challenge. One of the other companies that's developing a vaccine, Pfizer, for example, I believe its vaccine has to be stored at minus 80 degrees centigrade to remain viable. So you can see the challenges of that. We've got one of our own UK companies, AstraZeneca, in combination with Oxford University, is another one leading as well in the development of the vaccine. But there are over 100 potential vaccines in trials around the world. So now there is some optimism that with the amount of money and the amount of intellectual property and that is being thrown at this particular situation, that we can get something in the foreseeable future. I think a lot of this will depend where it comes relative to expectations. So quite often the important thing is in market is, you know, what are people expecting now and what will happen relative to those expectations. And the recent survey conducted by Deutsche Bank, 67% of the participants within the survey said they expected to see a vaccine developed in a period between 6 months and 18 months. So therefore, I would say if a vaccine were to be developed before 6 months, that would be unequivocally positive news. But if you start looking out after 18 months, then that could be seen as something more of a negative. So I think those are the kind of parameters that you have to hold in mind when you're checking your expectations for the development of a vaccine. And we won't even go into the mindset of the people who think a vaccine is being developed with a view to Bill Gates putting a chip into your brain to control your mind or whatever it might turn out to be. The sort of the main probability scenario, which I would call the sort of the U shape potentially, which is I assign a 50% probability to, and just by the way, I assign about a 10% probability to the silver bullet of the vaccine, is the sort of muddle through, which is kind of what we're doing now. I think you could describe this as also liquidity versus lockdown. So on the one hand, we're still remaining in a, you know, socially and physically distanced world. There are a lot of restrictions on us. We're a long way to returning to normal. On the other hand, there's huge amounts of liquidity being provided by central banks, which is very supportive to both the financial markets and to the economy. And obviously, as Victoria referred to, extraordinary amounts of fiscal stimulus being applied by governments as well. But of course, I call it fiscal stimulus, but it's a replacement for activity that's not happening. It's not exactly incremental stimulus as one might normally think of, for example, when governments like to spend. So that's sort of what we're going through at the moment. Markets are sort of chop around a little bit, but with a generally slightly more positive trend. The third scenario I put out is the sort of a W-type shape or a grind lower from here. It's about a 30%, as I say, probability. This would be where we don't really manage to sort of pin the coronavirus down. It keeps on popping up. There are a lot more and more severe rolling localized lockdowns, probably not widespread ones in the way that we've seen before. But economic activity never really starts picking up again. The jobless rate starts going up as well, and job losses remain more persistent, for example. And then the worst one of all is what I'm going to term the disaster scenario. And this is the one where we just don't really recover at all. And I think this would be associated with the virus in particular, just continuing to get worse and possibly mutate. The good news is that it's showing little signs of doing that so far. So at least, our target is pinned down, as it were, at this particular point. But that would take markets, certainly equity markets, down to levels below what we saw previously. But as I say, that's a low probability scenario. All in all, that leaves us with a relatively sort of neutral outlook in terms of our risk profile at the moment. The other thing that I just mentioned for the second half of the year, which I think will be very important, is the US presidential election. Obviously, right now, you've got Joe Biden well ahead in the polls, and that could obviously take the country in a very different direction to what we've seen in the last few years under Donald Trump. The first thing that he would do is reverse some of Donald Trump's tax cuts, particularly for companies in the US, so that would put a bit of a dampener on earnings for companies over there. But on the other hand, I think he'd be a safer, should we say, diplomatic hand than Trump has been in the last few years. So that could sort of equal itself out. But certainly gives us potential for a bit more volatility in markets over the next few months, and it'll be something to distract us perhaps from all the other things that are going on, such as Brexit in the UK and the virus itself. So with that, I will hand back to Victoria.
Thank you, John. So we've got a few questions come in. So I'll read some of those for you all now. The first one, actually, John, if you don't mind not resting your voice for too long, actually picks up on one of your points. Oh, I think it probably makes sense to lead off on that. And you were talking about UK equity markets being the big laggard and the potential for dividend cuts. And the question, I think, relates to this because it says, what are your expectations for UK dividend payments?
Yes, so what we've done so far, we've been running a sort of probability weighted index of dividends for the main companies in the UK. And currently, our expectation is the overall dividend payment from sort of UK PLC this year will be down 58% on 2019. So whereas the UK stock market used to be by far and away the sort of the major developed markets, the largest dividend payer and the highest yielder, it is now losing more than half of that dividend income. So it's a big loss, certainly for a lot of investors who rely on their portfolios for income generation. Now, this shouldn't necessarily be a permanent factor. Some companies, as I say, particularly in the banking sector, who probably could have afforded to pay dividends have been effectively told not to by the regulators to conserve capital just in case things go, even worse in the economy. But there are other companies who've taken the opportunity to rebase their dividends to more sustainable levels, from which they might be able to grow them faster in the future. And actually, I think if you, look back over history, you'll find that companies with a slightly lower dividend yield who grow them more quickly tend to perform and give you better overall total returns than companies that just start with very high payout ratios and high dividends. So it's not necessarily all bad news at the end of the day. And we're also looking at other areas of the portfolio where we can look to pick up income, whether that be in selective areas of real estate, for example. I'm not talking about sort of shopping centers and stuff like that, but more things like sort of GP surgeries, for example, logistics companies, those sorts of things. And also in the sort of corporate credit markets as well. So to say it's going to, I think it'll garner a lot of headlines when we see these confirmed dividend cuts coming through. But again, the market has done a good job of discounting it, and I think people are generally expectant of what's going to happen.
Thank you, John. Just a reminder to all our attendees, if you do wish to submit any questions, you've got a panel on your right-hand side for my Q&A, so do for Q&A, so do pop anything in there as they come. We have got a couple more, so I'll press on with those that we do have. And one of them, I think, is probably addressed at me, someone who shares my enthusiasm for the Office for Budget Responsibility numbers that were published yesterday. And the question is asking what we make of this story that was published in the Financial Times yesterday, which pointed to the OBR looking at tax increases of 60 billion or a return to austerity and that being needed to get the public finances to balance. And I think they're quite staggering numbers that, the FT, the OBR are absolutely right. Boris Johnson's probably, he's promised, he said that we're not going to return to austerity. So, I mean, clearly, we're looking at something, if he sticks to that, that's a very long road to bringing the UK public finances back to balance. 60 billion or so, you're talking about the likes of the transport and defence budgets chucked together. So they're enormous sums which would need to be found and which you're not going to find without economic consequences. And so, yeah, I mean, I can see why Mr. Johnson might be talking about dealing with such balances over a prolonged period. But they're very significant, and there will be economic consequences that come with scaling back the public finances and bringing them onto a much more sustainable track. It's interesting also to think about that fiscal adjustment that needs to happen alongside where we stand on monetary policy because, if you look at where we were on our forecast for Bank of England interest rates, where the Bank of England was indicating rates might go, a few months ago, at the start of the year, there was still talk about gradual and limited interest rate rises. Well, in the context of the drag that would come from bringing the public finances to balance in the scheme of the numbers that we're looking at, you know, it's quite clear that the one place to find some support for the economy is likely to be on a continuing basis from monetary policy. So, you know, that means lower interest rates for much longer. I mean, certainly we have no interest rate rises in over the next few years, and obviously, you know, continued support coming from those wider channels such as quantitative easing. So, you know, at the moment we're still in firefighting phase, but it's going to be really interesting to hear the timescales over which Mr. Sunak seeks to address the fiscal position, the spending review and the budget in the autumn. And I think that's the most likely timing for him to at least set out a plan. And then, you know, for the central bankers of the world, because it's not just the UK, there will be many, many governments far and wide tackling the same issues. What we're then faced with for interest rates and how monetary policy can provide the support that it would then need to do over the future years. Just a reminder, if you do have any questions, continue to pop those through. I can see we've got another one here that's addressed to John. So, John, it asks, what are you watching for in the current corporate earnings season? Are there any major trends or themes emerging?
Yeah, well, it's a bit early to see major trends or themes emerging. So today, or this week really, is the first week of the corporate earnings season. It always kicks off with some of the major banks in the United States, for example, and they're quite a good sort of bellwether, I guess, for what's going on. Interestingly, yesterday we had two or three of them reporting, and they had to put aside some very large loan loss provisions for potential loans that are going to go bad over the next few months. And in some ways that was hardly surprising, but I think it was the scale of it that was somewhat larger than was expected. On the other hand, they have been making money hand over fist in trading markets over the last few months. There's been an extraordinary amount of dealing and trading going on. So to that extent, you know, that's balanced it off to a great degree. But overall, the market sort of did look at that pickup in potential bad loans and took that slightly negatively at that point. So that's the sort of first big trend coming through is the financial system still robust? And I think so far, I think we're okay on that particular front. Then it'll be really looking, you know, I think two things we want to look at in particular. One is just how much damage has been done to those companies who've been badly affected. So in the services sector and retail sectors in particular, and what is their outlook going to be? You know, what sort of shape of recovery do they see? What is their capital position going to be in their liquidity? Are they going to start to have to raise more equity funds from investors, for example? So I think that will be a good snapshot there. And then on the other side of it, all those companies that have done exceptionally well out of the coronavirus situation and lockdowns, it'll be to see just, you know, how much better they can do. Do we keep on extrapolating these trends, or will they have reached some sort of plateau? And, you know, maybe we'll find that we've just become a little bit too excited about the prospects for some of these companies. So I think those are the sort of, you know, key themes that we'll be following through the results season.
Super. Thank you, John. We've got a lot of interest in what you said. You've got a couple more questions come through for you. So firstly, John, if UK gilts go negative, presumably their value will stop rising as they did in Japan. That's the first question, if you don't mind taking that, please, John.
Yes. I mean, obviously, when you buy a bond, there are two sources of return from it. One is the income you get from it, and the other one is the potential for capital gain if the yield pushes lower. So obviously, right now, if you buy a government bond in the UK, let's say you buy a 10-year bond, I can't remember off the top of my head, about 15 basis points or something. So, 0.15% of annual income from it. So you're not really getting any income. So you're relying almost entirely on capital gain for making your returns from buying a government bond at this point. So you'd have to see the yields go negative to make a capital gain from here. And as we've seen from bonds in other countries that have gone to negative yields, particularly in Japan, Switzerland and Germany, for example, there does seem to be a sort of floor beyond which they are reluctant to go any further. So maybe you can get down to maybe minus 0.5%, maybe minus 0.8% or something like that. But we haven't seen things going to sort of, you know, minus 1%, minus 2% yields yet. So that would certainly seem to put a constraint on the potential for returns from government bonds from here. So, you know, what you would say as an investor, you're taking on at this point an asymmetric risk in that you can't make very much return from your bonds, but you could potentially on a mark-to-market basis lose quite a lot of money if those yields went shooting up at some point. And I think that's a big question right now, because people are talking possibly, as I mentioned earlier, about more inflation coming back into the system. There's no consensus on this. There's a massive debate going on within the financial and economics community about that. And you know, there's strong arguments on both sides of it at this point. But if inflation did come back and people demanded a higher premium from and a higher return from their bonds, then you know, yields would go up and you definitely lose money on them. The question then would be whether, you know, central banks would sort of oppose that by keeping the yields pinned down, something that's they will do through quantitative easing and something called yield curve control as well. But that remains to be seen. Only the Bank of Japan is the only one which has really committed itself to that so far. So, they're very little return potentially left, I think, from gilts at this particular stage.
Interesting. We have a question that relates to how you know, businesses, people continue to operate after lockdown. I think also this is probably one for you, John. It's asking, will a balanced portfolio in the future have a lower stake in commercial property, given that home working may dramatically restrict the demand for office accommodation? Do you have views on that, John?
Yes, I mean, it's fair to say that we've had relatively low exposure to sort of traditional commercial property anyway within our portfolios for the last few years now. We've tended to look more at, as I said, I mentioned earlier, GP surgeries is one area which has been quite an interesting one of growth, and that's, you know, government backed and effectively index linked as well, which is quite handy. Things like social housing, for example, logistics type companies. So there are certain areas of commercial property that have actually done, you know, of real estate that have done reasonably well, even throughout all this. There's a price for everything. You know, I don't think the office is dead necessarily. I know there are plenty of my colleagues who are just raring to go back to the office at this particular point because they're fed up with being at home for whatever reason that might be. There's also that sort of, you know, there's the more collegiate aspect that you get of being within an office environment and the sort of the idea of, you know, ideas being generated at the water cooler moments and all that sort of stuff, and the people you know, pass in the corridors, if that's ever going to be allowed to happen again. Sure, it will one day. So, you know, the market will rebase itself to the right level. And then from there, I think we'll be able to see if there are decent returns to be made. But I don't think there's any hurry necessarily to go down that route.
Interesting. Now, Brexit, we have got virtually through a whole session without the B word coming up, but we have had a question come in on Brexit. So with issues such as Brexit still to be finalised, the question is, should we be looking more globally in our portfolios rather than in the UK? Again, John, it would be super to have your thoughts on this, please.
Yes, I mean, I think generally we should be looking sort of more broadly and continuing to look more broadly for companies around the world anyway, Brexit or not. I think, you know, the UK companies, we often point to the fact that about 3/4 of the revenues and earnings from the FTSE 100 are generated outside the UK anyway. So it's not as if, you know, the stock market in the UK is entirely driven by what's going on in the UK economy. Brexit as such, at this point, we're obviously in some shape or form fairly close to the end game now. Whether it'll be a deal or a no deal still remains to be seen. In some ways, there won't be an awful lot of difference between those necessarily. I think the whatever deal Mr. Johnson and his team come up with, it's going to be what we would have described only a year or two ago as a very hard Brexit. But the only thing I can say with any certainty is that whatever deal we have, it will not be as good as the previous trading arrangement. So it's definitely going to be worse than we saw before in terms of our relationship with Europe. But I think in terms of looking at the international opportunities of not just investing in the UK, I would definitely believe that to be the case. And I think that is the way that portfolio is going to move more over time, either through investing in individual stocks or investing through mutual funds, for example, or even ETFs, where you can take that route and it's still relatively low cost to do that. But that gives you a much greater breadth and depth of the sort of companies that you can invest in. So yes, in the UK, we have world leaders in certain industries, but we are very much lacking in world leaders in things like the technology industry. At the large cap level, we're lacking in leaders in sort of, in the industrial engineering type sectors, for example. So I think, the wider that you can spread one's net, the better in terms of getting the best outcome for clients from a choice point of view.
Thank you. So we've reached the end of all of our submitted questions. I just wanted to say thank you to all of our audience participants who've joined us today. And for John, thank you very much for your excellent insights. I do hope you'll join us again. We've got another session on Wednesday, the 29th of July at 10 o'clock. I'm sure the invites will be going out for that soon. But in the meantime, have a good couple of weeks. And thanks again for joining us.